Hello and welcome to the Dilipram All-Rounder podcast. It's the 2nd of March. We're recording at 2:30 p.m. And we're going to rewind back to 2005 today and talk about the start of the Australian tennis summer. And we are reliving the 2005 Australian Open final between Leighton Hewitt and Murat Safin. In this episode, we'll cover the lead up to that Australian tennis summer, the players involved. Mind you, it was a very awesome time in tennis because we had a meeting of the old and new guards. We'll look at the big issues that were present at the time, and we're going to do a list of our best players never to win a Grand Slam. So stick around for that. We're going to look at the top five moments, some would you believe that, and then get stuck into some of the topical issues currently in the tennis game. But before we do that, I'm going to introduce my guest. My guest today is Ashwin Srinivasan. I met Ashwin when I think I was 7 or 8 years old. He was my neighbor in Eastwood, I think just one or two streets away. And I always knew him as the science guy who could bowl a wicked outswinger. His LinkedIn profile has his name as Senior Embedded Software V&V Engineer. I don't know what that means, but the description goes further and says, quote, test automation execution in Python, electronics and hardware setup, firmware error identification and debugging, reporting and documentation, end quote. I don't know what any of that means, but the man is a good bloke. You won't find better. We used to hang out a lot of the time. We haven't caught up as much of late, but Ashwin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dil. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet me. Yeah, it actually has been a while. Ashwin, before we get in, if you could pick a sport that you could have been a professional athlete in, which one would it have been?
Professional athlete. Maybe, like, the sports I'm best at are probably cricket, but, you know, I don't think I have what it takes to be a professional athlete for sure. But I feel like something like frisbee throwing and that kind of thing.
Wow. Yeah. Are you just
the
worried?
Niche sports.
Okay. I'm saying God gave you a blessing and he said you could be a professional athlete in any sport and you've picked frisbee throwing. Okay. I love it. And who's the GOAT?
The GOAT of which sport? Any
I don't
sport?
Know. I just said who's the GOAT.
Oh, who's the GOAT? I'm just going with Bradman. He's the GOAT.
Beautiful. It's been a pretty common answer, and I'm glad Bradman's getting some love. Now, let's rewind back. We're talking about 2005 and the Australian tennis summer. Before I do that, if I say 2005 to you, do you have any memories of that period of time?
Well, that was the year I was in year 12 and I did my HSC. So that's the biggest thing for me. And we actually, my parents like kind of demolished our house and we rebuilt our house at that time as well. So moving to a new house, HSC, that was pretty big.
That's huge.
Time for me. That's, yeah.
And were you, I think back in 2005, we were living quite close to each other.
Yep.
And we were playing quite a bit of tennis. And I recall our tennis was always, we'd always start at the end of cricket summer, or we'd start playing in summer and then gear up for the Australian Open and then play right through winter. It was a really good time to play tennis, I think.
Yeah, it was. But did we actually play around that time? I feel like we started a bit later, like 2007 or something. Because 2005, you would have been, what, year 10?
I was year 10. I think we played a little. We played off and on. So we had a couple of other family friends, Sriram, yeah. and my brother used to play. And Karthik, yeah. Ramesh used to play. So these are all family friends of ours. I was playing quite a bit in winter and I think we played off and on, but then our tennis really started in 2008, yeah. 2009. But it's funny. I think we're talking about the Australian Open and I always found that my love for playing tennis would kickstart around the time of the Australian Open. You'd watch all these tennis superstars play and you'd think, well,
I can do that.
Yeah. You'd think I can do that. And obviously we couldn't do it. 1% of what they could do, but it was always good to see all these stars converge on Australian soil, and it just motivated a lot of Australians to go out and play.
Yeah, I never got a chance to actually go to the Australian Open for a long time until like much later. I went 2015 or something, but around that time, 2005, as a kid, that's when I really wanted to go, and sort of, you know, it was hard to convince parents to get a ticket.
Yeah. I didn't go. I think Sydney International was our best hope
of
going. And that the Sydney International was still there, but it was a very interesting point, I think, 2005 in tennis and tennis worldwide. From an Australian standpoint, you had Rafter and Philippoussis almost in some senses transitioning out as aging Australian superstars. And you had the rise of Hewitt. He was, to some, some would call him beloved, but others might say he was a little bit confrontational. He was a little bit aggressive. He had that Australian hard-nosed mentality.
Yeah, he had a, there was a bit of a period where he had like a kind of a war with the crowd. So he, you know, they'd support him and then someone would say something and then he'd go off at them and then there'd be like a, you know, Australians not wanting to support him and then, but then at the same time, he'd have a lot of support. And
Yeah, exactly. And I was reading something about in the New York Times at the time, and they said, quote, even though, and this is about Hewitt, they said, quote, even though he continues to inspire ambivalence in a country that would really prefer that its tennis champions hold their big serves and keep their cool, this was his well-earned chance to silence what remained of the doubters and become the first Australian man in 29 years to win the tournament that Australians like Rod Laver, Emerson and Rosewell used to win just about every summer. Mm. And that's what the New York Times wrote in around 2005 of Hewitt. He was coming off a fairly solid Sydney International win. Mm. And the pressure was on for an Australian to try and become the next winner of the Australian Open. I think the last person that won it was Mark Edmondson in 76. And he won in 76, and then Pat Cash made a final in, I think, late 80s and had lost in five.
Yeah, okay.
And then since then, Australians just hadn't.
Rafter did win a couple of US Opens, I think, but he never was able to get an Australian. And, it was, and Hewitt did win Wimbledon, and I think, like, probably for him, he would take that over an Australian, as a lot of people would.
You would. It's the Wimbledon almost seems like the grand slam that most tennis players dream of winning. But that final and that 2005 Open, it came at a transition point in the powers of world tennis. We had Sampras retiring at the end of 2002 after he had won his fifth US Open. And then 2003, Ashwin, saw a number of different winners. You had Agassi win, Juan Carlos Ferreira win, Federer winning his first Wimbledon. He beat our beloved Philippoussis in that final. People say it was a three-set match, but there were two tiebreaks in there.
Yeah.
You know, a tiebreak can go anyway each time. So Federer won, and then Roddick won.
Look, I think that was a solid lull period in tennis. There was like...
2003?
Yeah, just between 2002 and 2005, you know.
Yes.
Like, I don't want to disrespect, like, you know, Gaston Gaudio and those kind of people, but they just, like, I feel like they wouldn't have achieved what they did in any other era. Like, they just, that period in those few years, some people just were able to get a win.
You're right. It was because, as you say, that name, Gaston Gaudio, 2004 saw Federer dominate basically all the Grand Slams, save for the French Open, where the beloved Gaston Gaudio won his one and only Grand Slam title. Mm. Now, the final itself, we'll get into hot seat because there's a few issues I want to cover, including that build up to the final for both Hewitt and Safin. But the final attracted many viewers in Australia, primarily due to the presence of an Australian superstar, averaged 4.05 million viewers, and it remains one of the highest view counts in Australian history for broadcast TV. Mm. It was a match was broadcast in the host nation by host broadcaster Seven Network. Bruce McAvaney and Jim Courier, I think, made his first appearance in 2005, and we've seen him on TV ever since.
Yeah, I distinctly remember Jim Courier.
He's it's going back a while. I've always seen him on TV, but 2005 was his first time. Let's get into hot seat, Ashwin. The first hot seat I had before I get stuck into a couple of media ones was green courts. So I had green courts because when I was rewatching a few of the matches to get myself into the 2005 zone, it was quite odd just to see the ball. It was actually quite difficult to see the ball at times on those green courts at night or even during the day. Until 1987, the Australian Open was played on grass courts. And since then, there have been three different types of hard courts that have been used. and that green-coloured Rebound Ace was used up until 2007. Mm. So that's the court we had for this tournament. And it felt like a proper hard court, save for the fact that it was green colour. So it looked like you're playing on Wimbledon.
Yeah. I mean, I think with the hard court, so the idea is that they can adjust the sort of speed of the court, right? So that's when they change the different court types. And I think I remember like Federer complaining that the court had slowed. And I can't remember if that was 05 or a little bit later. It might have been when they changed the
right.
In 07. But so he obviously wanted it fast like Wimbledon, where grass, you know, the ball stays a bit lower and faster. And then you've got the other end like clay where it's sort of slower and bouncier.
I mean, in some ways, I am a fan of the green court because I think when I think Australia, I think green and gold. And that green embodies everything I think it means to play tennis and what it means to be in Australia, green. And when they shifted to blue from 2008, I kind of felt it. Tennis was becoming homogenized and the Australian Open was following the US Open style. Yeah. And we should be distinct. It should have its own features and unique features. But I will say green's on the hot seat because if you'd rewatch some of those games, you can't even see the ball. So there's difficulties there. Next one. I had two words. It's finals disappointment, question mark. And the reason why I had that is that I think the build up to that final, particularly for Australian fans and for Hewitt and Safin in that semi-final, was defined that Australian Open. And in some ways, the final itself was an aftershow, an afterthought.
Yeah.
Because when you think of Hewitt, we could probably spend a little bit of time on this. Hewitt's run-in to that final is, it's one of the great right. run-ins. It's some of the great names in tennis that people yeah. will forget, but he played everyone in that tournament.
Yeah, yeah, and there were a lot of them were five setters as well, yeah. like Nadal, Nalbandian.
Nalbandian.
Roddick. Like.
So when you step back, so Hewitt comes into the Australian Open. He's won the Sydney International. He's in some form. He has not won a great, I think he'd won Wimbledon in 2002. He'd won the US in 2001, beating Sampras. Hasn't won a Grand Slam for a while. And then he first faces Arnaud Clément, the French, the aging Frenchman who had a penchant for, you know, beating some decent players in his time, but disposes of Clément. Then he comes up against James Blake in the second round. Now, people forget that match, but I remember watching that match live because it was, for me, I'm in year 9 and it's school holidays. The first week or first 2 weeks of the Australian Open are school holidays still. So watching the James Blake game, I think it was a late afternoon game. James Blake takes the first set and he should win the second set, but then tensions arise. He loses a tiebreak and then just basically loses the game. He loses in 4. But Hewitt's in trouble from the second round. And then he comes up against Chela, the Chilean, I'll call him a star, but Chela and Hewitt have their own issues.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And you remember that game.
Yeah, I remember there was Hewitt had a lot of words with him. And, yeah, there was a spitting incident, wasn't there? Was that with Nalbandian or Chela?
No, Chela.
Chela, yeah. Chela.
My dad used to call him Kuchela. There's an old Indian story or tale where there's a person called Kuchela. So I always used to think he's Indian and call him Kuchela. But they were
walking after a game just past each other and so some words were said and then someone, Chela spat and then, yeah.
He spits in his direction.
Yeah.
And there's some innuendo or rumors that some words are said by Hewitt which causes Chela to spit at him. Could be lost in translation, but I think it's worth mentioning 2005. It's the age before Twitter. It's the age before instant social media reaction.
Yeah.
Now, and I say that because even the match against James Blake is heated and follows a very controversial match where Hewitt and Blake played in the US Open. And there were allegations of Hewitt making claims that the linesman was on James Blake's side because they were on the same skin color and making comments like that to the judge, to the umpire, caused a lot of controversy. Mm. And Hewitt wasn't really Blake's friend. Yeah. And Blake showed that at times in that game where he's doing the come on in front of Hewitt.
Yeah.
And then he plays Chao. There's a spitting incident. It's not a good look for the Australian Open, but it was that Hewitt aggressive, hard-nosed mentality, which I often associated with the Australian cricket team as well, which made me not like Hewitt as much. But he beats Chao. So he's played three rounds. You think you're only in the fourth round. Then he comes up against Nadal.
This was obviously before Nadal hadn't won a Grand Slam yet. He did actually win the next slam. But at that time, I had no idea who he was. I'm not sure anyone else did, but it didn't seem the commentators really. They were just like, oh, this new young guy.
It wasn't a jacked up Nadal.
But he did have this, like the...
he had the singlet.
Yeah. So did Hewitt, I think, in those days. So
he did. And Nadal almost wears the same outfit as Hewitt. They're both wearing this blue top, but Nadal is wearing, he's not wearing shorts or pants. He's wearing those three quarter pants. And that match goes to five sets. And it's, Hewitt talks about that match afterwards. And he says that Nadal, it's quite easy to say this, but he says Nadal's one for the future. This bloke is going to be a superstar. He was very complimentary towards Rafael Nadal. I just remember that last point in the fifth set where Nadal, I think, knew he wasn't going to win that game after he lost the fourth set tiebreak. And Nadal walks over, almost says, you're too good on this occasion, I'm going to get you next time. And I think after that game, I don't think Hewitt beat Nadal again for a long time. So he was one for the future. Beats Nadal, then faces Nalbandian in the quarterfinals. And the reason I want to just talk about this is because I think Hewitt's run-in is worth talking about. It's one of the great run-ins where you isolate all these players and he's beating all of them, where I don't know if he was a favorite in a lot of these games.
Yeah, I mean, that's what led to the big viewership in the final. The fact that he had all these great battles and it was in the news and everyone was paying attention, and it just created an amazing build-up for the final. It wouldn't have happened if he had sort of cruised his way through.
Exactly, and he comes up against Nalbandian
in
the quarters. And Nalbandian, to me, is interesting because he didn't strike me as a great server. Or it wasn't a serve and volley, but he had a heavy ground stroke that really caught a lot of players caught a lot of players off guard with how heavy his strokes were. It was very much like in the Del Potro, heavy hitting from the middle of the court, and he was able to dictate points a lot of the time, which was why he had successful wins against some of the likes of Federer, Djokovic, even later on in his career.
But at the same time, he doesn't have the ability to win a Grand Slam.
No, but he did make a final. So he made the Wimbledon final, loses comfortably in three to Hewitt. But that Australian Open 2005 quarters, he had it in his grasp. He loses 10-8 in the fifth set. And I think the world now was paying attention to Hewitt and thinking this was his best chance to win. Comes up against Roddick in the semifinal. And surprisingly, he's too good for Roddick in four sets. And I thought after he beat Roddick, I thought he'd beat Safin in the final. But because his run-in just seemed so difficult. And the fact that he was beating all these players made me feel as if he was probably the favorite going into that.
So had Roddick had won one US Open before that, hadn't
yes,
he?
The, yes. The 2003, I think he won the US Open.
Yeah, I think he was seeded two, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Which
was a lot of players were, a lot of the people commented for Hewitt that he was lucky that he wasn't in Federer's side of the draw.
Yeah.
And Federer was in the other side. And it's when you think about it, that was Hewitt's run in. For Safin himself, Safin probably had a less challenging early run, but then comes up against Federer.
Surprisingly, I think he played Djokovic in round one and just thrashed him. It was just like 6-1, 6-2 or something.
He did.
Very one-sided.
Yeah, it was. I don't think anybody knew what Djokovic would be at that time.
Yeah.
And I didn't read anything saying this is going to be the next superstar, but Safin disposes of Djokovic, disposes of some other players, including Dominic Habardi. That's a name I hadn't heard for a while, but plays Federer in that semi-final. It's a famous semi-final. I think it's probably worth an episode in its own just talking about that match because of how interesting the game was just from contrasting styles. You had the magician in Federer who could play equally serve and volley. At that time, he was utilizing a lot more of the serve and volley back then when the courts would allow him to play that style. But then he's coming against Safin, who I think, was very dominant on hard court surfaces and liked playing those. He won his US Open on a hard court surface. And it was the one day where I thought Safin gave so many, he gave Federer so many chances to come back to that game. Like, he gave him a match. He had match points in the fourth set for Federer to take the win. He had so many chances to complete the match in the fifth set and just couldn't do it. And you thought Federer was going to win again.
Yeah, that was my actually like proper first viewing of Federer. Like, I know he'd been obviously winning in 2004. He'd won three slams, but I hadn't actually really paid attention until 05. That's when I really started watching tennis properly for the first time. And just seeing Federer play and just those, like some of those, the way he'd do those half volley kind of pickup shots where like no one else was doing that. And he would sort of pick up the ball in the half volley and hit a quick forehand down the line. And yeah, that was just, and the single-handed backhand, of course. And it's so like one interesting stat I just heard recently was that there's no single-handed backhand player in the top 10 anymore for the first time in like 30 years or something.
Which, really?
Yeah. And so it's basically the world has decided that that's sort of a thing that's not valuable anymore. And sort of the technique has died off and people have adopted the double-handed
backhand. It is interesting in that because you would have thought the single-handed backhand gives you more flexibility to reach for balls.
Mm.
But, and it is aesthetically more pleasing to watch if you just players like Gasquet, Federer, watching them hit a single-handed backhand, there's no better sight in tennis.
But perhaps it may have just turned into a power thing. Like, you just can't generate as much power. And in this day and age, you just need that to get on top.
Yeah. Well, some would argue the greatest player of all time. Others would say he's in the top two or three. But Federer utilized that single-handed backhand throughout his career and it worked for him.
Yeah. Some of the shots he played in Safin, like those backhanded slice drop shots, I feel like as a single-handed player, you can do that better than a double-handed player can because you just look like you're playing a normal backhand and then just slice it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And he was able to do that in that semi.
In that semi-final. And I think if that semi-final to me is one of the great games I've seen live and on tennis. And it's in some ways as we built into that final and Safin beats Federer in five, almost gives it away, but manages to win that game. You thought that he might not have the energy to compete in the final, at least my final hot seat, which was choker ? And I had that because Marat Safin coming into that final had already lost twice in the Australian Open finals.
And to Federer as well, just previously.
To Federer, the previous year. And would you believe it, do you know who he lost to the first time around?
Who was that?
Thomas Johansson. And I remember it was either at your house or I was at one of our other family friends, our Sriram, and the Australian Open final was going on at the time. And back then it was during the afternoon, the day the final would be played. But Safin announces himself on the world map by beating Sampras in 2000 at the US Open and then is very off and on and makes an Australian Open final. It's either I think 2002 or 2003, loses to Thomas Johansson, then loses to Federer in the Australian Open final. So people are starting to speculate, was he ever going to win this Australian Open? And now beats Federer in the semifinal, gets his revenge, but now comes up against Hewitt in the final. And he was on the hot seat because you don't want that record of having three losses in an Australian Open. I spoke about Goran Ivanišević in season one and his finals win and why it was so special. And one of the big reasons was that he'd already lost three times in the final.
Well, and that he was a wild card entry, like that. That's
true.
I mean, that makes it like that's probably the only time that's ever happened.
I think so. And Safin obviously wasn't a wild card entry, but people were starting to think, can he ever do it? It got me thinking, just with the pressure of winning a slam, I wanted to do a list, and I gave you some notice of this, which is the top five best players never to win a Grand Slam. And I think I wanted to show some love to some of these players because tennis is a hard sport. There are four chances to win a Grand Slam each year. But as we've seen in the last 20, let's say since 2005, if you're not in if your name's not Nadal, Federer, or Djokovic, you've basically got zero chance of winning a Grand Slam. And it just means when you do get a chance, you've got to treasure it. And there are a lot of players who've reached that level that never had a chance to win. So the first one I had, Ashwin, was Marcelo Rios. Do you remember him?
Yeah. I mean, I remember he was world number one for about a week or so.
Well, he's the only men's board. I think this is a correct stat. Stats people will correct me if I'm wrong. He's the only men's world number one in history never to have won a Grand Slam.
Mm.
And it's not for a lack of talent or what he hadn't done. He made a major final at the Australian Open in 1998.
Okay.
But he was stopped in the final by Peter Korda.
Okay.
And was penalized. I think he had some issues off the court a few months later. But he was a player that I just remember was able to hit miraculous shots, was a road runner, very similar to Hewitt's style, but it never found its way into a Grand Slam champion. And you would have thought the period in which he played was a period where he should have capitalized and been able to win a couple of Grand Slams, but wasn't able to do it.
The question is, how did he get to that number one spot without winning a slam then? Was it a matter of like other people pulling out and like somehow his ranking got elevated because other people lost their points?
The tennis ranking system is very strange, and probably we don't need to bore listeners with how it's calculated, but as I understand it, you get a lot of points for improving on your previous year's performance.
Yeah, but I sort of like that system. It's rewarding people who do better. And so you can't just dominate at the top and keep accumulating points.
True. But then
it gives other people a chance. And so if someone like Djokovic can maintain that spot, it just shows how amazing you have to be to do that. Because if you win every slam, then the next year you can't get any points.
Well, I would like to just know how the points work. Because if you're Djokovic, say you win a grand slam, all four in one year, and then the next year you runner up.
You lose points in all four.
It's a bit unfair. And then someone who was eliminated in first round at each of those years and then suddenly makes a semi-final.
Yeah, they will gain a lot of points.
Yeah, well, that's true.
I mean, I don't mind that system. Like, I think it rewards, like, improvements and it probably severely punishes not improving. But, yeah, I like it.
I think Marcelo Rios probably came, when he elevated to number one, it was probably at a time where Sampras was on the wane, Agassi was aging, and we had a period where there was no real clear-cut winner who would dominate all four surfaces. And Rios probably just found his... probably spent 1 or 2 weeks at the top, but never won a Grand Slam. So I had him in there. Mm. Who have you got?
I just remember those hard workers that kind of were perennially at the 3 and 4, kind of similar to Nalbandian kind of level. But Nishikori, for example, he had his chance. He went to the final of the US Open.
Yes.
And I think it was that to, who did he lose to? It might have been Del Potro or something, but.
Del Potro, yes. Or, yeah, we'll find out. Nishikori. Yeah. He did make one final. Okay, so you had Nishikori. I had Philippoussis.
Yeah, Philippoussis.
I thought Philippoussis' game deserved more.
But did he have much other than the big serve?
He had a very strong serve and volley game, I thought.
Yeah.
And a heavy ground stroke, a very solid forehand. The problem with Philippoussis was two things: injuries and sometimes fitness. He would tire out at the end of a game. Now, he was still very fit, but I'm just saying comparatively, because his game relied on a heavy serve and quick rallies most of the time. But Philippoussis, to his credit, he made two Grand Slam finals. He lost to Pat Rafter, I think in 4 or 5 sets in 97 or 98 of the US Open. And then he had that magical run in 2003 to reach the Wimbledon final. It was his best chance to win, but he comes up against a baby Federer who was too good for him on that day. And it was the start of the Federer run. So Philippoussis can take some credit for really kick-starting that Federer magical run.
Yeah, yeah, he can. I think that losing the finals like several times really, it's going to crush you mentally.
Yeah.
It's going to make it really difficult to come back. Like, you look at Medvedev recently, just lost. He was 2 sets up in the final, now twice in the Australian Open. So he lost to Nadal after being 2 sets up, and now he's lost to Sinner after being two sets up.
That is
like
true.
That kind of thing, I think, will take a huge emotional toll.
And tennis, it's a very different sport in the sense a lot of it is mental. I think if I take it to the amateur level where we're playing, I think when I come up against someone whose style is so different to mine, sometimes you feel like you just can't beat them. And you might actually be more talented, but if their style is very different and it conflicts with how you play, it's all mental sometimes. And I think the mental aspect of it is sometimes underrated.
Yep.
And as you say, someone like Medvedev, who could easily make this list as well of not having won. Has he won a Grand Slam?
He did. I think he won
one.
US.
Yeah, he won one. So the other two, you mentioned Nalbandian. The other two I had was David Ferrer and Thomas Berdych. I thought those two players, Berdych has made a final, but David Ferrer was just in the wrong time.
Yeah, he came up to a French Open final against Nadal and you really have no chance.
You got no chance. But their styles of play, very different styles of play, Ferrer and Berdych. But from Ferrer's perspective, I just think he was blocked out by Murray, Djokovic, Federer and Nadal. He came around that time. His game wasn't at that level. But if not for those, he may have won two or three Grand Slams based on his heart and drive.
I did see a bit. So when I went to the Australian Open final, semis, I saw Berdych versus Murray and then Wawrinka versus Djokovic. And like both of those were really good games.
Oh, definitely. I still haven't gone to the Australian Open. I've been to the Sydney International, but it's nothing compared to the Australian Open. So I have to do it. Ashwin, we'll take a quick break and we'll be back with best moments. Best moments, Ashwin. We were just talking about this quickly in the break, but one of my personal memories of Hewitt, I don't think this is controversial, but I never really enjoyed watching him play because I personally enjoyed, I'd come from starting to watch a lot of Sampras back in the day when I was a lot younger. So I enjoyed watching serve and volley. And then the game, Hewitt's game was at the complete opposite end, which was he didn't have a great serve. He didn't have a great forehand or backhand, but he had a consistent game.
Yeah.
It was a game that could thrive on the surfaces, which would allow him to run back and forth, get balls and tire his opponents out. Very much like Nadal, but except he didn't have the heavy ground strokes that Nadal had. So my personal thoughts watching Hewitt were, he's not some guy I'd actually want to watch a lot of the time.
Yeah, I agree. Like, he doesn't really inspire. But, I mean, like, especially when you compare to Federer and, like, you know, just waving his wand, as Jim Courier would say. And, like, yeah, Hewitt, I think the appeal of Hewitt was just the fact that he could make a comeback, you know, and have a thrilling five-setter. And that was the point of watching Hewitt. It wasn't so much ground strokes and things. It was the atmosphere of how he'd, like, fight to the end. And
the come-ons.
Yeah, and the come-ons.
It would really stir the Australian crowd. I'll go in sequential order or chronological order because I thought the game, that's how the game worked. But the first best moment I had was the first set and essentially the first few games, and I had it as Hewitt on fire early. He took an early lead to dominate and win that first set. And it really came as a shock to a lot of people. To me, I was perhaps less surprised from what I recall of that, because I think I'd come from just watching what I thought was the greatest tennis game I'd seen with Hewitt, with Safin and Federer playing in that semifinal. And I'm obviously living in the moment and thinking that's the best game I've ever seen. And then you just thought Safin's probably tired. He's probably fatigued coming up to that final. And Safin said after that game, after the match, he'd actually commented about the first set and said, quote, "I just get so nervous. I got so uptight because it's the last match. You understand the situation. It's the last match. You have to give it your best. I don't want to lose it because then it's like nobody cares about the finalists, basically. For me, it's a little bit the third time to be a finalist and not winning a Grand Slam. It will be a real disappointment, a huge one." And I think that was playing on Safin's mind, the fact that he didn't want to be a finalist again and someone that people would forget talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it would have hurt a lot, like given that he'd like lost already to Federer, and so yeah, I agree. Like it would have been like really hard for him to lose again.
Yeah,
but the first set, it was just him doing unforced errors constantly. Really, like
yeah, it's not like Hewitt's hitting ground stroke winners.
Hewitt didn't really win the set. It was more just Safin lost it. And Hewitt just, it was 6-1 or something, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Or something, yeah. And
it was a no contest,
yeah.
That first set. And
yeah.
I
remember Jim Courier commentating going, oh, this is not what we wanted. We didn't want it to be this easy.
I mean, this is early Jim Courier, which was anytime he saw a shot, he'd say, stop it, or you can't believe that. And this is classic Jim Courier. But in that final, I think a lot of people were disappointed, almost wanting a spectacle, and that first set did not deliver. The next moment I had, though, was that second set where I call it Safin returns fire. Mm. I think that the end of the first set allowed Safin to just decompress, take stock of the situation, say, I'm only a set down. Let me just go back to playing my normal game. And what we saw happen was the ground stroke started becoming heavier. And by heavier, I think for anyone who plays tennis, they'll get an understanding that sometimes you hear the sound from the racket and you can tell that that person has either put a lot of topspin on it and it just, the ball is harder to return or hit back. And that's what happened to Safin's game. He starts dictating play from the back. He's not a serve and volleyer, but he was able to just stay in the middle of the court and point Hewitt to certain ways, and he stopped making unforced errors.
Yeah, I think that's the key as well. He just stopped making errors. So those balls that were previously going out are now going in and they're hit hard. And Hewitt is just not able to get on top of it. And Hewitt's it seems like he, as you said before, he doesn't take risks as much, right? So he's sort of returning close to the center and just waiting for Safin to hit the ball out. And if he's not hitting it out, it's just sort of...
What does he have
in
his game? But you say that, and I agree with you, but then we just saw Hewitt beat Roddick, and Roddick's game at that point was playing quite well. He had a very good forehand, very good serve. Hewitt disposes of him. He beats Nalbandian. So I think I don't want to say Hewitt's game wasn't great at that time. That was probably the peak of his powers, but he didn't have the quality of ground stroke or forehand that Safin possessed. The ability to just make or hit a winner from nowhere. That wasn't his game. That wasn't his style.
Yeah, I mean, his game was to sort of keep the ball in play and then like mentally wear down your opponent, like sort of making them believe that you're never going to give up and
that's
you're going to come back.
You play a bit like that from memory. Is that still your game style?
Probably, although I haven't played tennis in a long time. But it'd be good to get back to it. But
yeah. Exactly. And the next moment I had Ashwin was actually the third set where it was a moment where Hewitt breaks Safin and he goes up 4-1 in the third set. Now, when in the scheme of things, if you sit back and in hindsight, you'll forget about that because nothing happened. But I thought it showcased the mental strength of Hewitt where he just lost the second set quite comfortably. And any other athlete who knows that they're not at the level of their opponent. And I think Hewitt knew that if Safin played to his ability, Safin would win, would probably just give up and go. But no, Hewitt takes his game to the next level and goes up 4-1 in that third set. And you thought, we've really got a game on our hands.
Yeah, like that, it was great watching that. Like I remember watching almost every, I think I did watch the full game start to finish. It was like probably the first time I'd properly watched a Grand Slam, this one. So it was, you know, I had my own TV in my room for the first time in our apartment, while we're saying.
Your mum and dad let you have a TV in your room?
Yeah, because we had this old TV that we'd found when we
I'm
moved
I'm very
house,
surprised so, that your parents let you.
Yeah. So I put this TV in the room and then, yeah, and it was just watching every ball of this. It was amazing watching him come back. And I was really hoping for Hewitt to win. I didn't really, like I was sort of disappointed that Federer lost, and then I sort of took it personally against Safin. So I didn't want him to win. I really did want Hewitt to win.
So when it's 4-1 up in that third set, you're probably thinking, well, it's got a good chance here of winning.
Yeah, definitely.
And then my final best moment, it's it's basically from that point on, there's a not a controversial point, but I think Hewitt makes some remarks around that time to the umpire or the line judge saying, you're not the hero, mate.
Yeah, because it was a big thing with Hewitt with the foot faults. So I don't know if you remember, but Hewitt would always get called on foot faults. And there was a crucial moment in there in like the fourth set or something where the linesman said foot fault. And then he just, you know, he was really upset. And then there was another one where there was an overrule where Safin hit the ball and it was in, but the linesman said out, and then Carlos Ramos overruled it.
He overruled it.
And then Hewitt was like screaming at him. But, you know, the replays did show that he was right.
And that's where he comes up with, you're not the hero, mate, in this. Because I think this is also a point, a moment, and we didn't cover it earlier on, but the game of tennis back then was also different because we had lines, men and women, and we had umpires, and they were all involved.
Yeah.
And did we have Hawkeye back then? No. So,
I mean, we had Hawkeye for replays, but not for, like, the players couldn't use it to contest a call.
So. And the game back then, it was more involved because you had so many other people on the court. You've compared to tennis now, they almost don't use anyone other than Hawkeye, and the umpire just sits there and is essentially a match referee.
Yeah, it's more just the discipline now, the umpire, you know.
Do you wonder, those umpires, that's a sweet gig now. Just to go and sit on top and not have to do anything, because you never have to make an overrule.
Yeah, that's true. But then you have to deal with the, you know, the player's aggression and the discipline, and then, you know, the new woke era, you got to be careful.
Who pays the umpires? Is it ATP?
I think so.
Do you reckon, is it business class flights everywhere? I wouldn't mind being an umpire. Does anyone know what an umpire's salary is in tennis at the moment? Because you really don't have to do too much other than just tell players to calm down.
And watch the clock for the timing.
The clock. And so that point about the football, it's actually a very poignant moment because, as you say, Hewitt has this issue, always foot crosses the line. Back then, it's the lines person that will call it. And there's almost this unwritten sense or view that if you are called for a foot fault, you almost feel like you shouldn't be calling that.
Yeah.
And players would get very upset at the lines person that made the call. And I think that call and then Hewitt losing it at Carlos Ramos, I think, who was the umpire, set up the game. And I think from then on, he basically lost a lot of momentum, and it shifts into that final set where Safin wins it quite comfortably to win his second Grand Slam.
Serve just became like unplayable for Hewitt at the end. It was just aces, or just he just could not get a good racket on it.
You're right. His first serve percentage, it was actually under 50% in his first two sets, which for anyone that plays tennis, if you're serving well above 50%, you're likely to hold on to your serve or win a lot of games. Safin's was under 50%. And then by the third and fourth set, he was over 70%. So you hit it right on the mark. He was, aces were finally coming. He had 9 in the third set and he had 7 more in the fourth. And I just thought, I was going for Safin because I think at the time I was a little bit anti-Hewitt, just with the way in which he played, the controversies which he incited. I always felt a bit sensitive about like how he treated James Blake the previous 2 years, an African-American tennis player, and just some of the remarks he made. I like him now in hindsight, but at the time I think I was more supporting Safin. And so when Safin started firing up and hitting these serves, I thought, he's got it. And by the time we got into the fourth set and Safin's comfortably up, I thought, game over.
Mm. Yeah, I remember feeling like really sort of disappointed and down at that time when Safin did win. Because it just felt like all that effort he put in to get there, the 5-set games that he played all the way there, and this was his only shot. And you knew that he was never going to do much. Like after this tournament, I don't think
he
really achieve anything after that.
I mean, he beat some genuine superstars in his time, but to beat Sampras in 3 sets in 2001 in the US Open was something else. You got to give him credit. He was an Australian roadrunner.
And who did he beat in the Wimbledon that he won?
Nalbandian.
Oh, Nalbandian.
In 3 sets again.
3 sets, yeah.
The man dominated on the final stage. Have I missed any best moments?
I think that pretty much covers it.
Yeah, good. Would you believe that? I had two. The first one was The last major in which neither Federer, Nadal or Djokovic reached the final until the 2014 US Open. So it was a span of 38 events, and it remains the only major where Federer, Nadal and Djokovic all competed, but none of them reached the final.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so that but I think that tells you like the crossing over between the eras. So this was right at the, so it was a couple of years after the Sampras era ended, but it was just on the start of this new era. And I think we're going to get something similar to that again now, like in the era now that's going on, because it just, you have Djokovic and Nadal just ending.
Unbelievable though. Like when you step back, that 2005 to let's say 2023, we've had this era where if you had three of those players, any one of them playing, they're going to be in the final.
Yeah.
You don't get that in any other sport where three athletes dominate a 20-year period and it's just them. It's never seen anything like it.
Yeah, like I don't think tennis will see anything like that again. Like it's unbelievable that you have three people with 20 slams at the same time. It's just like astonishing.
Exactly. It was the last Grand Slam victory for Safin. He retired pretty early in his career. I think he retired at 29 or 30.
But at that time, I think that wasn't unreasonable. Like at that, like given Sampras, and so I think 30, it was sort of viewed as the time to go. It's only been more recent that athletes in all sports, not just tennis, it's all sports where you have to add 5 years now to what was previously the retirement age.
Well, 30 is the new 20 for a lot of these athletes. Yeah. They hit that 30 mark, and a lot of them will comment that we're just getting started.
Mm.
And you look at, if we look at even in cricket, a lot of these players like Usman Khawaja, as a cricket batsman, came back into the team at 32 or 33 and feels like he's just reborn. And I think with modern technology, health, the way in which research and development is going, a lot of these athletes have found ways to stay young, stay fit.
Definitely. And I think in the old era, like they obviously, I'm not sure fully, but I don't think they had access to all the kind of nutritionists and like it wasn't really a thing to have your own sports psychologist and nutritionist and personal like dietitian and all that.
It wasn't the huge teams that we see nowadays with certain athletes. I think Andy Murray was the first athlete I remember. There might be others. He's the first athlete I remember that when I looked at his entourage or the team he had with him, he had five or six coaches, and he was famous for firing his coach after 3 or 4 months. But he really had a large team, and I think he might have had a psychologist, he might have had other people working with him. But he was that first athlete that I really saw bring a huge entourage to his games, and I think a lot of other athletes have now embraced that sort of team.
Yeah, and I think Andy Murray was one of those kind of late bloomers, in the sense that he just wasn't able to achieve what he wanted probably early on. And then at the, after 30, he's able to win.
Let's finish with this, Ashwin. I want to look at the modern world, or what's going on in the world of tennis now. Mm. And there are a few things going on. The first point I wanted to cover with you was the lack of Australian tennis stars. Now, when I originally wrote that, I had Nick Kyrgios in mind. And I thought that the current Australian climate, the cupboard seems a little empty. We had Nick Kyrgios, who was playing so well 2 or 3 years ago.
He was,
hitting his stride. He was in form. He was fit, and he was making a final. He was just playing well. And then he's now been injured. And he started commentating at the 2000 at the last Australian Open, and I felt as if perhaps he's thinking about what's next in his life, and maybe perhaps tennis is not his main passion. And that just leads me to think, are we at a point in Australian tennis where we just don't have superstars that are going to be able to compete and win tournaments at the highest level? There's players like Demonor.
I think Demonor does look promising.
The Demon. Like,
yeah, he's in the top. Was he top 10? I think he might be.
Could be.
And yeah, I think we've got to give him a chance. And he's still young, so I think he does have a hope. But yeah, Kyrgios, look, to be honest, tennis was never his first passion. I think he's said that many times, that he's sort of just playing because he knows he's good at it.
Yep.
But he's not committed to it, and he publicly says that and gets flack for it.
But is there an issue in Australian tennis at the moment, or is it just something that happens? It almost is quite sad, though, compared to the bygone era where we had the Rod Laver's, Ken Rosewall's, Newcomb's, and then Rafter, Philippoussis, Hewitt. And now it feels as if we don't have someone that has, when they enter a Grand Slam, they have a legitimate shot of winning. I don't put Alex de Minaur in that category yet.
I agree.
Yeah. Perhaps we just have to be patient on that. But I feel as if the lack of Australian stars has pushed tennis back in the pecking order of popular sports in Australia.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. And I think it's not just Australia. I think the US are sort of experiencing a similar thing. I mean, they also don't have, you know, a great player in the top 10. And yeah, it probably something to do with the grassroots tennis and the way things are done for young players here. And I think there is a big barrier in tennis in terms of, like, if you want to make a career out of tennis, it feels to me, I may be wrong, but it feels to me like you have to be quite wealthy to do that. So tennis, you have to make a lot of investment to travel to tournaments. And it's not like other sports where you can sort of get into it based on talent alone.
I completely agree. I had a family friend who back in the day played tennis almost semi-professionally. It was playing with boarding with the likes of Agassi back in the day. And he made it, I think, up to a certain level. And just the challenge was, once you reach a certain level, say top 500 or top 600, to then push for top 100, top 200 is the challenge. And you need to have enough funds, or you need to be supported by the Australian Tennis Federation early on, just to be able to afford to get to a lot of these tournaments. And I think that's a big challenge. You're completely right. Tennis feels as if it's an elitist sport because it's all worldwide. You have to travel to all these tournaments. And if you're not of great wealth, then you're relying on other sources to get your funding. Mm. And there's only so much funding that Australian,
especially from Australia, where we're kind of isolated from Europe. And if, you know, a lot of stuff is happening in Europe, and if you're a European player, you can get yourself around a lot simpler than someone from Australia can. And I'm not sure if the local Australian, like, if you just want to have a career staying in Australia playing tennis, I don't think you can really get very far.
Is tennis too homogenous now? And by that, I mean, is the game, would you say you still hold the same love and passion for playing and watching tennis that you had before, or has it waned?
I think it's waned, and yeah, I guess you could say it's homogenous, but like, if you mean, you know, we don't see like serve and volley players anymore and that kind of thing, I agree. Like, I think we're losing a bit of that kind of extra flair and things, and it's probably just because Djokovic, Nadal and Federer sort of killed it off. Like, it's sort of difficult to be a serve and volley or a kind of unusual style, because you sort of know you're not going to be able to compete with the, like, you know, Djokovic or someone who has the ground strokes.
So you don't think, my view on that is, I think more can be done to vary up the game of tennis. Tennis lovers will say there's nothing wrong with the sport. It's big in Europe. It's big elsewhere. To that, I would say, I thought the sport was better when there was more variety, when the courts or the Grand Slam courts were so different that different players could emerge victorious on certain days. Look, before the Federer era, I know we had Gaston Gaudio and Juan Carlos Ferrer winning French Opens and Gustavo Kuerten, but it was beautiful because it meant you go to a different Grand Slam and then you suddenly see that there are 10 players who now emerge as possible candidates to win.
Yeah.
And then you'd go to Wimbledon. So you'd have a French Open, then you go to Wimbledon, and then suddenly you'd see different players, these big serve and volleys. Mark Philippoussis coming to Wimbledon saying, I've got a good chance of winning. Sampras dominating the serve and volley. Ivo Karlovic saying, I'm going to make a semifinal and I've got nothing but a serve. And I think there is a beauty in that. The broadcasters might say, well, no, we want a sport that will take, we want games to be 4 or 5 hours because we make more money. that way. But I don't know. Personally, I think I have a problem with tennis and the way in which it's played at the moment. I think it's just one style, which is heavy.
Well, is it fair to say that hard courts are sort of dominant around the world, and then you have clay like in specific areas and grass in very specific areas? And
it's hard court, clay, and grass in Wimbledon, but you don't really play grass anywhere else. It's essentially hard court outside of Europe.
Yeah.
And I was listening to one of my favorite pods, and they're not a tennis pod, but they were just talking about different changes to certain sports. And one thing they commented was that they said the game of tennis, a way in which you could make it interesting is racket technology has developed so much that it's made the sport quite dull to watch because everyone hits it very hard. Like the tennis racket is so well developed that you could be in a poor position and still hit a great shot. And they said, if you go back, what if you made the current players play with wooden rackets? Would that make the game interesting? And they said, if you play with the wooden racket, it is so much harder to hit the ball. You've actually got to hit it in the middle of the racket. Otherwise, you're going to make a mistake.
Yeah.
And I do wonder, they'd never do it because they'd never go back in years. But I do wonder if you suddenly made all these stars now with how strong and powerful they are, start hitting with wooden rackets, you might have a very different and interesting game to watch.
Yeah, definitely. I think like that probably contributed a lot to serve and volley disappearing because so when you come to the net, it's now with the rackets they have now, they can generate top spin and pass anyone from almost any position with the power that they never could with a wooden racket. And so coming to the net in the past was a lot more, you know,
there was
easier.
A lot of incentive to come to the net, whereas nowadays it's gone.
But, you know, technology evolves and you can't really take a backward step there. I mean, it's similar in other sports like cricket. Imagine asking them to go back to using bats from the 1980s where, you know, things would change a lot.
You're right. And I did think you would say that as a, you know, senior embedded software V&V engineer, that you wouldn't be a supporter of going back in time using old technology.
Pro technology, yeah.
I thought you would say that. Ashwin, a lot of fun doing this with you. I assume it's your first podcast, but have I missed anything or did we give it justice?
No, I think we did do it justice. Yeah, it is my first podcast. It was good fun.
Excellent. And it's a good excuse to catch up, but we'll talk about some cricket ones in the future. But thanks for coming on the show.
No worries. Thanks.